Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a journalist covering health, food, and the environment for the last 25 years. And every week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and our total health environment. I cover these issues on the Huffington Post, Alternet, EcoWatch, Intent.com, and a host of other sites. Every week on Connect the Dots, we make that connection between what is going on in our health, what we can do to be proactive about health, and part of proactivity is not just personal health care choices or consumer choices, but also social advocacy actions and things that we can do as citizens, as community members, as, you know, beings living on a planet of ecology to protect and preserve the resources and the ecological balance that we need for life and health. And every week on Connect the Dots, that's what we talk about. In this show, I am returning to a theme we've covered a great deal on the program over the last 4 years, and that is fracking. I was actually pretty much the first news cycle reporter covering the issue going back to 2009. We have thanks to Josh Fox and Avram Listgardner of ProPublica for doing some great investigative research, but I have probably been covering this particular issue longer than any other news cycle reporter. And I now do that on Huffington and Alternet, so you can look for articles there. On today's show, we've kind of taken a little bit of a hiatus from the fracking topic over recent months, but the evolution there hasn't taken a break. There's a lot that's been going on, and there's a lot of actions and things that we need to be aware about that that we're going to be focusing on in this program today, as well as in some of my upcoming programs and blogs. So this is a return to fracking with an update on fracking and gas development and infrastructures in New York State, where we have many, many listeners. We're going to have two guests on today's program, one in the first half hour and then another in the second half hour. So I'm very excited to begin that, and we'll be hearing about actions that you can participate in as well. So we're going to begin our show by welcoming to Connect the Dots Wes Gillingham. He's the program director of Catskill Mountain Keeper, which is one of the original grassroots advocacy organizations protecting the Catskills, the New York State watershed, from which people both upstate and downstate get their water supplied. Their organization is fighting for healthy food, sustainable growth, and dealing with a range of threats to that from fracking and its infrastructures. So Wes is really a lead organizer in this domain, and so we'll really be delighted that he's here, and I'm very interested to hear what he has to share with us today. Welcome to Connect the Dots, Wes Gillingham.
Thank you for having me, Allison. This is great.
So, you know, let's begin. You know, one of the things that kind of happened, I mean, Bill McKibben has called the grassroots organizations of this region, of which your organization is certainly one of the leaders, you know, some of the most amazing and successful grassroots organizing that has happened on environmental issues, you know, over the last century, really. And that's a high compliment, and it's also true. When I began covering this and Josh began filming and you began organizing, it was a little-known issue, and I think there is still a lot of ways to go, but a lot of people know a lot more about it and are concerned about it and motivated to do something about it than was the case in the past. That being said, since in early of 2012, we were basically hovering on the brink of New York State going forward with guidelines that would permit the introduction of actual fracking into New York State. That didn't happen, thankfully, because the Commissioner of Public Health took a step back to really look into the health impacts, which have been very little researched on this issue. So it's kind of, you know, in terms of actual fracking of gas wells in New York State, we hit the pause button. But that doesn't mean that everything stopped and nothing is happening. What is going on now, and what do people in the Northeast region need to know about and be concerned about in terms of current and future threats about this?
Well, Allison, I think you're really right. When, you know, when this whole thing started, you know, almost 6 years ago, that we, you know, we were told, well, you got to run around and try to get people to get the best lease because you're never going to stop the industry. But as we've seen, people educated themselves, learned about the issue, came out to hearings. The fact that the governor asked for a new regulatory package for drilling was really the education platform. But what happened when people started looking at the science and what the state was going to allow and the kinds of things, you know, the lack of protection, the lack of looking at cumulative impacts, really ignoring the air impacts, and then kind of denying some of the science around water contamination, you know, that was what made the organizing so successful. And right now, I think, you know, people have this impression that, oh, you know, we have a delay here, but we're really in a very precarious position because at any given moment, depending on the political whim, the governor could release the regulations that they had worked on for many years, and we could be facing the final supplemental generic environmental impact statement, which is, you know, the program that they are supposed to operate under, and a package of regulations that would allow it to go forward. The delay is the as you said, the health commissioner is looking at the impacts, but he's been doing two things. He's been reviewing what the DEC has in their document, and then he's been looking at some other studies. You know, recently he said in the public that there's some concern there, but you know, we are in this very precarious position around the health impact issue in particular. Mountain Keeper started, you know, asking for a comprehensive health impact assessment, which is very different than, you know, what's happening right now. There's, you know, Dr. Shaw is looking at documents, but we don't even know what he's looking at. We don't know conversations of, you know, which scientists he's having. A comprehensive health impact assessment would be it's a process that's recognized by the Centers for Disease Control and the World Health Organization. And you have a stakeholder group that's formed. You have public hearings. It's all in the open so that people can see what's being looked at. And if, you know, you go through the process and then all of a sudden it's, you know, the public has the opportunity to say, hey, well, no one here is looking at the radon issue and the fact that the gas from the Marcellus is getting to New York City in a short amount of time and there's a radioactive issue and a release of radon in people's kitchens when they're cooking, you know, and then you then force the regulators to look at that issue and whether that's a health issue. What's happening now.
So there's, without the transparency, that's really a problem. I actually have a current piece on the Huffington Post. It's not on fracking, but it's on the way that, you know, we revere science. The people revere science. We turn to science. We need science. But unless the science that is quoted to us, that is cited to us as the rationale for something, is really done in an independent and open process, a lot of manipulation can occur in science, and I think that's what you're pointing to there. You know, so even though the word science is used, unless it's done as you're defining it, there can be a lot of problems, and we see that not only in fracking in this arena, but it's in terms of the food supply, in terms of healthcare. You know, it all depends on who's doing it and what they're looking at. If you're just talking, we know that there has been, you know, certain academic institutions that have supposedly studied fracking, but they've been receiving funding from the gas and oil industry, and their findings seem tainted and have been discredited as a result. And so I think that really underscores the importance of the kind of process that Catskill Mountain Keeper is calling for here. One of the things that I'd also like to kind of open up for the conversation is, you know, we've been talking about, I mean, all throughout, I know when I first began reporting on this issue, it was kind of regarded as, oh, well, there are these kind of off rural areas that are kind of sacrifice zones, this is how downstate city people might regard the beautiful upstate Catskill region that's a source of our water and much of our healthy air and food as well. There wasn't, you know, great knowledge. It's just kind of when you're rushing around the city and taking the subway, you kind of, if you're health-oriented, healthy food-oriented, you kind of go to the farmer's market and you just trust the food will be there. You're not really looking into the entire food system and the interconnectivity thereof. And so in that way, initially fracking was just something that might, you know, if it happened, and of course the industry fought this perception as well, even though now it's been proven over and over and over, it might, you know, kind of taint the well, the water and the well of some, unfortunate rural communities kind of thing. And so it's viewed as a kind of isolated phenomenon that doesn't impact, whose impact does not spread beyond the region where that might occur to touch people all throughout the state. But over time, I think, you know, there are many reasons for understanding that ain't so. Can you kind of clue in our listeners a little bit more about why this isn't a local regional issue of one or two counties, but it's actually a statewide concern?
Well, I mean, it's a statewide concern. You know, number one, the gas field is, you know, covers a large portion of New York from the Catskills to the western part of the state and almost up to the Mohawk Valley. There's both the Marcellus and the Utica shale there that could equal long-term industrialization of that whole region, which comes with the truck traffic and the emissions from the truck traffic, the problems with the drilling. I mean, it's an inherently toxic industry. But one of the things that really stands out in terms of what you're talking about is, okay, I'm living somewhere and I'm not near a well pad. But there's a whole infrastructure that needs to be built to create a market for all this newfound gas that's coming from fracking operations. So right now there's over 35 infrastructure projects going on inside the state. You've got the Millennium Pipeline is a major pipeline that runs across the southern tier of New York down through the Catskills into Rockland County above New York and hooks into the grid that, you know, provides gas to the metropolitan area. You have the Iroquois pipeline running across basically the Mohawk Valley and connecting to northern New York and into New England. They're building they're attempting to build pipelines to connect those two, which gives them marketability to get Marcellus gas to the New England system or to Canada, where there's the potential for LNG export. There's an LNG facility that is being proposed off the coast of Jones Beach, and they're calling it an import facility. But there's huge questions there why anybody would be investing in bringing import when there's a glut of gas in the U.S. right now. So what most people are thinking is that and it's an easy political process to change that to an export facility, that it's gearing up. Because one of the issues that an industry has right now is the price of gas is low. So the more markets that they create, it could bring the price of gas back up and they can make higher profits. So we've got these pipelines going in, and with every pipeline, in order to move the gas, they have to have compressor stations all along the way. Compressor stations are making people sick wherever they are and wherever people live in proximity to it. You know, there's high levels of chemicals that are being released from these compressor stations during what they call blowdown events, where they're, you know, either doing maintenance or there's, you know, a problem with the pipeline and they have to empty a section of the pipeline. They're releasing benzene, toluene, xylene, arsenic, barium, chromium, all these things into the air at phenomenal levels if you're living near one of these compressor stations. People get nosebleeds and various respiratory issues. One of the problems is that, you know, how they're regulated. And like just recently up here in Delaware County, there was a compressor station that did a blowdown they evacuated folks from their home. But, you know, we're in the process right now of trying to scramble and find, like, no one took air sampling while that was going on. Like, what was what the situation is there? How far did the plume travel? You know, that's all depending on air conditions, the temperature of the air, the wind direction, you know, current weather. And this stuff hasn't really been analyzed. I mean, the industry basically gets a rubber stamp from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to go forward with these things, and the communities are left with this. Down in Minisink, near the Port Jervis, New York, there's a compressor station that was built there. And the irony of it, it's in an area that has I think there were 10 9/11 survivors that moved to that area because of health problems that were created from them. These rescue workers who worked at 9/11, police officers and firemen that were there, and they moved out there to breathe better air. And now they're facing having to move again because it impacts their health to be living near this stuff. And there's a Algonquin market improvement project that's taking gas across the southern part of New York in Rockland County, under the Hudson, over to Connecticut to reach the market in Boston and Rhode Island, Connecticut, across the bottom of Massachusetts. And there's a whole series of compressor stations being put in there, and large, and they're expanding the size of the pipeline. And this stuff is just multiplying left and right. They need to create markets, and they are, going whole hog. And people, local people who are paying attention are getting it and fighting it, but it's smaller groups in very local areas that do not have a lot of resources. And the FERC process, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is a real rubber stamp. And then these communities are dealing with these health hazards. It's a horrible situation.
So, and this, what you're describing, so it's kind of like what we had kind of thought when we began looking into fracking, is kind of like if you had like a mosquito bite, on your arm or something, and everyone's going, well, that mosquito bite isn't on my arm, it's not in, it's not in a critical area or whatever, but in fact it's connected to your bloodstream, it's connected to your nervous system, it's connected to your entire body. So what you're saying is it's not just the gas. I mean, this is fairly obvious, but it's something I think a lot of people haven't thought about. It's not just that the gas shows up in this one location and then, it has a bad effect when it's fracked there and pollution happens, but in fact it's traveling, it's transported, it's carried, it's treated, it's dealt with, and there's a whole network of what you're describing is an entire network of pipelines and compressor stations and ports taking gas abroad in a different, in a liquefied form. All of this has to be treated all along the way, and so wherever it's being used, it goes, and it's going through, and it's not just New York, it'll be going through New England, as you're describing it as well. In terms of the compressor stations, like we've heard a lot about Minisink, I've reported on that on Alternet, but I mean, how many, for example, compressor stations in New York State could we potentially be talking about?
Well, I described those pipelines that are running, from one end of the state to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that happens as they increase production and are moving more and more of the gas, they either need to, expand the pipeline and build a bigger pipeline. But before they do that, generally what they do is just add compressor stations. They basically increase the pressure, the ability to increase the pressure and keep it moving faster.
Mm-hmm.
It increases the volume of gas that they can ship through the pipeline. And some of the pipelines have a compressor station every 40 miles. So you're talking quite a number of these across the state and in various, sometimes in residential communities, because they need to put compressor stations where there's a T in the system and it's, taking the gas from one place to the other. And there's, compressor, they are building a number of what they call bidirectional compressor stations so they can switch the direction of the gas, that the gas is flowing through the pipeline, to travel to a different market or to an LNG facility. And then there's this whole other aspect, mentioning LNG facilities. just this fall, the DEC released regulations for small what they were referring to as small LNG facilities, and it was going to allow for LNG facilities to prop up, which there's been a moratorium on LNG facilities since the 70s because of this horrible explosion that happened at an LNG facility on Staten Island in 1973. And there's been a moratorium on that because of the safety of them. Well, there's this whole push now to, again, creating new markets for long-haul trucks to be able to fuel up on LNG. There's a whole host of scientific problems with LNG trucking and facilities. But the DEC did not put a cap on the size of these facilities. And it's really unclear about, you know, one thing that really sparked my interest is the DEC used information that came from Expansion Energy, which was a company that stands to profit from these small LNG facilities. And they actually developed a LNG facility on basically on a tractor trailer, that they could go to a well site and create LNG and then truck it to one of these smaller facilities or truck it to a pipeline. And that, in theory, opens up a new market for isolated well projects. They could be doing vertical wells and in various places looking for the hot spots on the Marcellus. And then not have to worry about the big investment of the pipeline. But then you've got these LNG trucks, you know, traveling around the state. And the emissions, when you have LNG, they have to release in order, they basically blow up if you don't keep the pressure right on the system. And they have to be constantly evaporating. It's an evaporative process, so when a truck pulls up to one of these facilities to fill up on LNG, they have to release a certain amount of gas that's in the system. And no one has looked at what the impact of all this new methane being released from a build-out of facilities. And this goes back to the, you know, a five-year-old argument that, you know, you talked about on your radio show and in your writing, and, you know, we were all talking about. With the build-out of the Marcellus and this whole new investment in gas, it keeps us from making the necessary shift away from carbon-based fuels that we really need to do to save our environment, our climate, our weather. You know, these extreme energies that we're extracting are killing the planet, and it's starting to come back and bite us. And Hurricane Sandy and Katrina, and then not even that, but all these small isolated storms, the numbers of tornadoes. If we, as a society and as a state of New York, invest in gas as our future, we're kaput, to use a technical term.
Yeah, you know, as I've been listening to you, that's exactly what's been going through my mind. I just want to say parenthetically, LNG is liquefied natural gas, which is, you know, put into a particular form as you're describing for trucks, also for export abroad. So a lot of this gas some of it will be going to meet American energy needs, you know, vis-a-vis the promise of energy independence, but much of it also, if there is enough, could be, be shipped abroad for higher prices. But, you know, the thing that all of these infrastructures and these different uses, this is a $1 billion build-out. This is not a bridge to renewables. If that same money were to be devoted to developing renewable energies and renewable infrastructures, we wouldn't need the bridge. We would be going there. And one of the reasons that renewable sources, you know, in people's minds are, oh, we can't really, you know, get the energy we need from them. Well, the reason that is the concern is because the infrastructures aren't in place. And so here we are, even as we, you know, don't know whether fracking will occur within the boundaries of New York State or not, it's happening in neighbor states, and we're we're on the roadway. We're on the superhighway that's being invested in instead of investing in energy sources that, you know, would help stall what we're, you know, what every climate scientist and, you know, and what we're seeing, you know, this these drastic changes in the climate that will continue and accelerate. What can people do to make their voices heard about this?
Well, there's various things. You know, any one of the local organizations that are in the fracking fight have a website and send out regular emails, blasts. You know, we have CatskillMountainKeeper.org, mm-hmm. and you can go to nyagainstfracking.org. And you know, one of the things that a lot of organizers are looking to right now is getting people up to Albany on January 8th. For the state of the state, there's going to be a protest outside where we're gathering to show our opposition to going forward with this natural gas infrastructure and the development of natural gas, and calling for a statewide ban.
And would
that
the
pressure
ban be-
needs to keep happening because of going back to the beginning of the conversation. We're in this precarious situation where the governor is this, has the sole authority on this right now, and you know could say yes or no to fracking and gas development across the state. And we need to keep the pressure up on the governor. He's claimed that he will follow the science. So again, paying attention to, you know, to the, your local organization's website and watching the science and educating yourself about, you know, the issue itself. So when a hearing for LNG facility comes up or a hearing for a compressor station in your community, you're armed with information that is science based. And, you know, again, keeps the pressure on our electeds to make better decisions than they have in the past.
So, listeners, you can sign up for this kind of information and activist announcements at CatskillMountainKeeper.org, and you can also sign up on their Facebook page and, you know, find out what's happening, get involved, and you know, make your voices heard. You know, the thing about it is we don't know what the governor will do. I mean, hopefully fracking will never come to New York State, but through all the things that you're describing, fracked gas is coming everywhere, because even, you know, even if it's not drilled here, which we certainly hope to prevent, you know, we're, New York State is very much part of the highway. So, you know, for its transport and its transit and its use. So in that context, you know, what does a ban mean actually?
Well, I mean, there's two things. Is it helps prevent the continued build out of the shale play, so that you know it's less gas that they're looking to. You know, so if you actually did get a ban in the state, they would not be able to develop that. That equals, you were talking about a bridge. I always like the analogy of it's, you know, it's not a bridge fuel. You're not building a bridge. It's a gangplank for our future. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it prevents the industry from, again, investing and doing expansion like that. We're dealing with the expansion from the Marcellus, from the drilling in Pennsylvania, in terms mm-hmm. of all these pipelines and compressor stations. We need to fight those on a local level mm-hmm. as much as we can. And, you know, Mountain Keeper is poised for lawsuits when, you know, the some of these things come down the road. But we really need... it's the general public and it's the voters that really change the decision-making process. You know, we've testified on this issue with technical comments, you know, for many years, but it's really the volumes of people who are saying, no, this is not what we want for our future. We want other choices. We want renewables. Politicians will listen to that because they realize they will not get elected if they don't make the right choices. So that's, you know, that's it in a nutshell. We need the power of the people in this particular situation.
I also want to mention that you have two educational forums that you're co-sponsoring that are going on actually tonight and tomorrow night for people who, you know, are near these regions. One is occurring tonight in Montrose, New York. The other is occurring tomorrow night in Mayo Pack, New York. It's educational forums about the Algonquin Gas Pipeline Project with speakers who will be talking about safety and health impacts. So, you know, go to the Catskill Mountain Keeper website and you can find out more about these events, where they are, what the time is, how to sign up. We're going to have to take a break here for station identification. I want to thank you so much, Wes, for being with us on Connect the Dots today and sharing this important information, and urge our listeners to follow up and take action. Really, you are the fuel for the right kind of energy and the right kind of change in terms of our political process. Stay with us for the second half of the show. We're going to be talking with Claire Donahue of the Sane Energy Project, more about pipelines and infrastructures. So stay with us during the station break on Connect the Dots. Thank you so much for being with me today, Wes. It's been great
having
you.
Thank you. A pleasure as always.
Welcome, listeners, back to the second half of Connect the Dots. We're all fighting off colds here in the chilly, snowy northeastern region. So if you if you hear us clearing our throats or blowing our noses, that's why. We had a very warm fall thanks to some climate change, and now the weather has shifted gears, and we're having a kind of snow and cold and snowy holiday season here. So, you know, bear with us, and please bear with me if you hear me blowing my nose, because I've been affected by it too. Welcome back to the second half of Connect the Dots. We're talking about an update on fracking and allied projects in New York State. In the first half of the show, we were talking to Wes Gillingham of Catskill Mountain Keeper. If you missed that, please check us out later in the Connect the Dots archives. If you're just tuning in with us now, welcome. The second half of our show is going to be very interesting and build on the first half. My guest now is Claire Donahue. She's the founder of the Sane Energy Project. You know, when Sane Energy started a couple of years back, it was really the very first time that it was drawing to people's attention the fact that the fracked gas, the shale gas that we were discussing in the first half of the show, is actually going to be carried somewhere, somehow, in order to reach people. And as we've been discussing, that's via pipelines. It was the Sane Energy Project that really first drew attention to the Spectra pipeline, you know, which now unfortunately is down in Lower Manhattan. For years they were raising awareness and fighting that. But it's not just one pipeline, as we've been hearing. It's many more. It's an entire infrastructure. So Claire Donahue has really been a pioneer. She's a citizen advocacy pioneer in raising awareness about these pipelines and all of these infrastructures and how they affect us. So I'm so pleased to have you here with me today and Connect the Dots. Welcome, Claire Donahue.
Hi, Allison. Thanks so much for the nice introduction. I should say that I'm only one of the founders of Sane Energy Project. There really are about a dozen people who started it, and it's really, you know, it's a group of people doing this. It's not just one.
I think we've had some other of the founders on. You know, the whole thing with grassroots activism, which we can kind of sidebar on that a little bit, is that it involves normal citizens. These are not professional organizers or people, you know, who've just been doing that and, you know, have a chip on their shoulder, who fly from issue to issue. These are people, ordinary people with other jobs, who do other things, who have families, who have made the time and made the commitment, you know, to do something that really protects us all. So can you orient people, just for my New York City listeners, a little bit, if in case there are any that haven't heard of the Spectra pipeline, tell people about that, its current status, and the concerns about it before we kind of branch out to the rest of the state?
Right. So, you know, the Spectra pipeline is the first of what is becoming a network of pipelines to deliver the gas into the New York market. We first got notice about it 3 years ago. So the process of going through its public and FERC review, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in Washington, has taken 3 years. And the pipeline went online as of November 1st. And this is, you know, one of several pipelines going up the west side of Manhattan that are now carrying gas directly from the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania into New York City. And just a few days ago, on Monday, we finished the first comment period for another big pipeline that's coming into the New York market, the Rockaway Pipeline. So, you know, the Spectra was sort of our, you know, making us learn how this process is, what is this process, how does it happen, making us realize what an undemocratic system it is, and how, you know, as Wes was saying, how rubber stamping the FERC process is. So it was the first of many pipelines into the city and now all over the state that we are, you know, trying to fight off.
What is undemocratic about the process?
Well, so, you know, when you come into this sort of situation as a normal person, as I did, you know, I'd never done any activism before I got involved in this. And, you know, you may have this idea that something called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission might actually be a government agency that is going to decide whether or not a project is in the public interest. And, you know, my assumption starting out was that this agency would be looking out for the interests of the citizens. And 3 years later, I have a completely different perspective, which is that this agency and many others are simply put in place to expedite these projects. They're basically going through a checklist of, you know, is this particular piece of paper filed? Has this particular, you know, agency looked at this and signed off on this? If all of those agencies have signed off, the project is going to go through, and 99% of pipelines get approved. So, you know, and the checklist and the regulations are, you know, primarily written by the industry themselves. So the environmental impact statement for all of these projects are paid for by the applicant. So Spectra Energy paid for their own EIS. You know, Williams Transco paid for their own EIS for the Rockaway Pipeline. So it's a really stacked system, and the amount of influence that citizens can have via public comment is a little bit skewed, you know, more than a little bit.
And what are the problems to citizens of these pipelines that are not being addressed? I just also have to say that, you know, my current piece on Huffington is about the same exact thing in the healthcare industry, where drugs are or food substances like genetically modified food seeds and all the rest of it are studied for safety and their health impact by the very companies that stand to profit from their sales. And this has been regularized. You know, if it concerns a drug, for example, a pharmaceutical drug, you always have the right to say, no, thank you, I won't take it, even if your doctor suggested it. If it is a GE organism, a GMO, it's in the food supply, you know, maybe harder and harder to avoid. But with pipelines, you know, kind of crisscrossing our region and with compressor stations, you know, if you live there, you're, you know, or downstream or in some place that's contaminated, you're going to be very hard put to avoid it. And this is not, you know, personal health choice, it's being made for all of us. So, you know, what are the concerns?
Right. So, as you said, you know, these decisions are not made democratically. They're made for us. In New York City, the decision was made for us by Michael Bloomberg, the outgoing mayor, who decided that New York City would convert to gas. And, you know, when he was in office, I guess that's still present tense, he also decided that it would be a good idea to frack upstate New York in order to get more of that gas. You know, well, we've held that off, but the gas is coming out of Pennsylvania's Marcellus Shale. And, you know, what happens in these processes is that the companies are thinking way, way ahead of us. And we're always trying to catch up. So at the point that a community is notified about a pipeline, it's so far along in the process of the design and the financing of this, you know, that communities are at a real disadvantage. And it's a very, you know, obscure kind of, you know, thing to walk into and try and, you know, get up to speed very quickly. So, for instance, there's a pipeline that we just found out about, you know, about a month ago, this AIM pipeline, the Algonquin incremental market. They always give pipelines great names like the Constitution pipeline. You know, they found out about this pipeline kind of late in the game, and it turns out that they're enlarging a pipeline that's along an existing right-of-way that people weren't necessarily aware of, you know, and, you know, you have a very short time period to alert your neighbors, get people activated, educate them about what the risks are. The AIM pipeline, like, you can't make this stuff up. They are planning to cross the Ramaco fault line and drill under the Hudson River right next to the Indian Point power plant with this pipeline. So let's put an explosive gas pipeline across a fault and next to a nuclear plant. Won't that be a great idea?
You know, after Fukushima, they haven't learned anything. And what is the risk factor for explosions with these kinds of pipelines? Is that something that happens, you know, never in our lifetime, or what kind of risk factor are we looking at there?
So here's how FERC looks at the risk factor. In their boilerplate language for their EISs says the risk of, you know, a pipeline exploding is of dying in a pipeline explosion is far less than the risk of dying in a car crash. Of course it is. You know, people die in car crashes pretty much all the time. However, you know, most car crashes don't take out an entire neighborhood or community, which is what happens when pipelines explode. So it's about the proportion of damage. And in terms of frequency, when I first started looking into this, the frequency of pipeline accidents was about once a week. Now it's about every other day. So there's more pipelines being built, which means there's more accidents happening with more frequency. The existing pipelines are aging. So the oversight and inspection system for pipelines is completely inadequate. Only 7% of pipelines are required to ever be inspected. And out of that 7%, they're only required to be inspected once every 7 years. So this Spectra pipeline, the AIM pipeline, will only be inspected once every 7 years, you know, and pipelines, all pipelines age. These pipelines will be 50 years old too, very soon. So it's a real problem. The whole regulatory system that's set up here is really difficult for people. And, you know, what we're coming to the point of realizing we've been, you know, tracking these projects as they come along. And it's kind of like looking at a needle point from behind. It's like you can see something going on there, but you can't quite put it together as a complete picture. And then suddenly what we've realized with all these networks is that, okay, so we heard about a pipeline in Connecticut. Well, why is there a pipeline in Connecticut? Okay, well, now we realize, okay, it's going to connect across New York State via this AIM pipeline, via the Constitution pipeline. And their goal is to create this network where the gas will go north to Canada, because that they'll use it to, you know, help, you know, develop tar sands there, north to Nova Scotia, where there's an export facility being built, south to the New York and Long Island markets, and then south, they're actually going to reverse the direction of some pipelines because the gas in Texas is running out. So they're going to reverse the pipelines to deliver the gas to export facilities in Texas that are already approved. So,
and what is this gas going to be used for? I mean, they're putting it everywhere. I mean, is this all needed just to turn on the stove? We could be using an electric stove. I mean, what is all this gas being used for, actually?
Right. Well, so the gas that's, you know, being transported for export, you know, is you know, they're hoping to ship this overseas at great profit. There's definitely a campaign to convert heating from oil to gas, you know, going on all over the country. And this is the particular focus in New York City. So 2 years ago, the law changed, which outlawed these heavy heating oils. So in New York City, you used to look up in the sky and see, you know, black smoke coming out of a building. And that was from malfunctioning boilers burning this heavy number six oil. So that oil is now being outlawed. And there is, at the same time, this concerted effort to build new pipelines into the city and within the city to convert people's you know, boilers from this oil to gas. And so the skies suddenly look a lot cleaner. You don't see the black smoke as much. But the problem is that using more of this gas is, you know, it enhances the demand to frack more. And if you frack more, you're releasing more methane into the atmosphere. You're creating more climate change. You're creating more air pollution because these emissions travel from the drill sites and from all these pipelines, which leak all over their path and the compressor stations that support them. So there's air emissions that are traveling in a radius of 200 miles from all of this infrastructure and increasing climate change in a place like New York City, which is an island that is, you know, obviously now we know really susceptible to flooding from, you know, superstorms. So it's a problem. We're basically committing suicide by converting our boilers to gas.
And is that something that, you know, who's making that choice? Who right. has a say in that?
Right. Well, individual buildings, you know, do have a say in their energy choices. Mm-hmm. The law requires you to stop burning this heavy oil, which is a good thing. We don't want to be burning this polluting oil anymore. However, they're not required to convert to gas, but most building owners are not aware that there even are alternatives. And it turns out that buildings can make other choices. For instance, biodiesel doesn't require any pipelines to use, is a renewable resource, you know, creates almost zero particulate matter and far less emissions, you know, than any of these fossil fuels. So, you know, it could be a much better thing. Buildings could be putting solar thermal on their rooftop because why are you running a boiler at all in the middle of August, you know, mm-hmm. to heat your hot water? You don't need to run a boiler at all in the summer if you have alternative means. So there's all kinds of alternate technologies that are just now beginning to get some play with the city and hopefully with a new mayor who's focused on efficiency, that will continue to grow and we'll be able to prevent more buildings from converting to gas. But there really has been a push to do that over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, what about this? I mean, I have, you know, written a bit in a very sort of, you know, this whole Fukushima, you know, at the week that it happened, I was on the phone with a colleague planning a trip to Japan where I was going to speak at an organic food conference. This just kind of made a very powerful impression on me. I did a lot of international research, and really a lot of the things that are just coming to the fore now, the fact that it travels, that we're not monitoring it, that it affects the food supply, particularly in the westerly regions, but potentially everywhere, the lack of monitoring, and now the dangers of a disassembly project going on over there, the fact that this was not just, you know, an isolated thing, again, as we always tend to think, that affects someone else, but really an ongoing problem. But the biggest, you know, is something that I've tracked from day one, pretty much. Didn't report on it because I kind of, that much, because, you know, at the time, the lead environmental reporter of the New York Times was writing things like, the only thing we have to be concerned about is that people will become anxious about this. And yet we've seen there's, you know, more and more cause. But, you know, to me, to hear that a pipeline under the Hudson that's going by an old nuclear power plant of a similar make and model to the one that blew up in Japan is like begging. It's suicidal. It's begging right. for destruction. What can people do about this? I'm sure my listeners listening to this will be concerned as I am. How can people take action? How can they get plugged in and involved? This is something that cannot be.
Right. I mean, so, you know, the first thing is to become aware of what's going on because, you know, there are projects like this happening all over the state, all over the country. So the first thing is to tune in to find whatever local environmental or activist or grassroots group near you is working on this and you know, find out about that. In New York City and in New York State, one of the big things that we're working on now is, you know, as a line of defense, if, you know, we can't stop every pipeline yet, we still want to make sure that the gas that people are going to be using in their kitchens and in their laundry and in their boilers won't give them lung cancer. And, you know, radon was mentioned earlier in the show. So
yes.
The problem with extracting this gas from the Marcellus is that that shale is highly radioactive and is very close to New York City and New York State, so that by the time this gas gets delivered to where you're cooking with it, the radon hasn't decayed. So we're really concerned that as more and more of this gas comes to New York City, people will be exposed to radon, you know, inside their apartments. In New York City, kitchens are very small. They're very enclosed. They're usually very poorly ventilated. I'm a kitchen and bath designer by trade, so I've seen a lot of New York City kitchens. And so it's a real concern. And we have been working with Linda Rosenthal, the assemblywoman, and Diane Savino, the state senator, on a bill that would force the utilities in New York State to monitor the radon and to mitigate it should the radon levels become dangerous. So in January, the legislature goes back into, you know, play, and we really want people to call their assembly people, call their state senators, make sure they sign on to the Rosenthal radon bill. You know, mm-hmm. that's a real thing that you can do. With the LNG projects that are coming, so the LNG port off of Jones Beach and the Rockaways that was mentioned earlier, this is a project that can be stopped. It has been stopped before. They've been trying to get this built 9 ways from Sunday, and they keep reapplying and reapplying. We need Governors Christie and Cuomo to veto it. They have the power to stop it altogether, so we need people to call Cuomo and say, ban fracking, veto the LNG port. So, you know, there really are things that people can do with very little effort, you know. And if you're more motivated than that, you know, grassroots groups like, you know, Sane Energy Project and Catskill Mountain Keeper, it's like, basically, we need your energy and we need your time, you know, more than anything. So, you know, get involved. I mean, I never expected to be doing this. And, you know, I have to say, if you're anxious, if you hear about these things and it creates anxiety, you know, if you're feeling despair at the way the world is going, the only way out of that is to take action. And it really feels good to be doing something about this rather than just hearing about it and thinking, oh my God, you know, what is the world coming to? So I really encourage people to get involved, because it doesn't just help the world, it makes you feel better. You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you're not sort of just isolating in the corner and stuck with it. You're kind of doing, you're getting into motion, you're getting into action. I mean, the definition, you know, the actual energetic signature of, for example, depression, this is speaking as a longtime health reporter,
right,
is that, you know, you kind of turn inward, you dampen down the energy, you isolate, you maybe do addictive behaviors, you hide, and it dampens
right.
all your life energy, whereas if you go with the movement, if it's outrage, if it's fear, you know, if it's sadness that this is happening in our world, in our society, to future generations, go with the energy, allow it to move you to action, and that's actually a healthy expression. It's not, you know, like an angry, ugly, weird thing, as is sometimes misrepresented. And the people that you'll meet along the way, as I can testify, are just some of the best people you ever want to know. Now, I want to just give people your website here, saneenergyproject.org. That's saneenergyproject.org. You can subscribe there. You'll receive emails. There aren't too many of them. They'll let you know when you can take action. It's really quite easy. You can sign up also on Sane Energy Project's Facebook page. We're coming into the end of our show here, and we'll have to have you back because there's a lot more to discuss. So, you know, thank you so much for
thank
being
you.
With us today, Claire, and keeping us up to date and informed about what's happening and what we can do about it at Sane Energy Project. And it's been a joy having you. We'll have you back. And listeners, thank you for being with me today on Connect the Dots. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network. And you can also check out my current blogs. I'm going to be doing a blog on this on Alternet. And I'm also revivifying my eZine, which has been a little dormant for a while. So if you want to go to healthjournalist.com and sign up, I'm blogging more regularly, and I'm going to be sharing those links with my readers as well as upcoming radio programs. So thank you so much for being with us this week on Connect the Dots, and take action. It's time.